Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode preparing you for Veterans Day. That's coming up this Thursday, November 11th. So be on the lookout for observances in your hometown and put 8 p.m. on your calendar to check out the documentary debuting on the History Channel, Hidden Heroes, the Nisei Soldiers of World War II. It's complete with excerpts from some of the oral histories that the Go for Broke National Education Center has been conducting with World War II veterans of Japanese ancestry since 1998. We hear a lot about the 442 and the 100th Infantry Battalion, but there were about 6,000 Nisei in something called the MIS, and that includes Clarence Suzuki.
MIS is Military Intelligence Service. The service was activated during the war from the Presidio of San Francisco, but because of Roosevelt's 9066 that issued on February 19, 1942, that school in the Presidio was closed, and the school moved to Camp Savage in Minnesota. And from there, it was, you know, getting too small. More and more students were coming to the school, so they transferred the students over to Fort Snelling, a bigger place. But I might have ended over there, or I could have ended up in the infantry, you know, gone into some other outfit, not the 442. But because of my language training, I was fortunate. I was sent to Tinian. They flew me on a C-54 with all the officers. I was the only enlisted man on that plane. Flew from Honolulu to Johnson Island to Kwajalein and landed in Guam. From Guam, I took another transport, DC-3, got to Tinian. So I stayed on Tinian as a Navy Japanese language interpreter. This was part of the military government at the time, and I also went to Saipan. But Saipan had a place called Shalan Kanoa. That's where the Chamorros were. Most of the other Chamorros were on the island of Guam.
The time where you were in the Saipan and Tinian area was right after those battles had been fought to win American control of those islands?
I was there after the post-war, you know, period, but we had to take care of the civilians. We also had captured the Japanese soldiers, and there were a few of them running around in the hills. So I carried a Smith & Wesson 38 to be on the safe side.
What did your duties consist of at this time, and what was the strategic importance that that you were carrying out?
The guys that were there earlier were with the 27th Infantry. They're the guys that was probably around 13 people headed by a Caucasian officer. But one of the guys in that outfit was Dick Kishiwe. He was from Hanford. He just passed away last year. But my duty was part of trying to help the civilians, you know, get back to normalcy. They were in a big camp called Camp Churro, but there was some soldiers hiding in the camps too. They would periodically kill one of their own guys, you know, one of the Japanese civilians, for being out of step with their doctrine. Plus, the ones that were prisoners, they had to be taken care of health-wise too. So we had a field hospital to take care of these people, the civilians and the soldiers. That's what we did on Tinian until they closed the base around April of 1946.
And when did you get there?
I got there August 15th, 1945, just after the war ended.
Right when the war ended, a couple weeks before they signed the treaty. Well, it strikes me, since Tinian was where the Enola Gay took off from to drop the bomb on Hiroshima, where were you when you heard about that, and what was the significance for you?
Well, the bomb was dropped before I landed on Tinian, because I think August 6th and August 9th, I got there August 15th, about, you know, a couple of weeks after the bomb. But, you know, talking to the guys too, I mean, they were all shocked that they had the atom bomb there. We you know, we could go over to the base, Northfield. They had three bomb wings, B-29s. One was on Guam and one on Saipan, but Northfield on Tinian was the big air base. Post-war, I was able to go to the Enola Gay, and I had a picture taken with me in front of the airplane. But all the guys that were there before me, most of the guys were Navy that you know I was with. They were shocked, and you say, "Oh my God!" You know, they didn't know about the bomb, two bombs actually. My understanding, talking to these guys, you know, they were bombing Japan for some time already after we took Iwo Jima. The B-29s were already bombing Japan all over, and what they were doing was firebomb Tokyo and all the big cities, Nagoya, Osaka. So by the time August, you know, came around, there was no need to drop a bomb, an atom bomb, because Japan was already ready to surrender, but the emperor didn't come out soon enough, and that's why the first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. But my understanding is that the bomb was not intended for Hiroshima. It was intended for Kure. Kure was a naval base, big one, right north of Hiroshima. But because it was all clouded over, they couldn't see the target. So they kept going south, and then there's Hiroshima. It's all clear. So my understanding is, hey, you know, why not drop the bomb there already? Get the hell out of there. But the same thing happened on August 9th on Nagasaki. The intended target was, forgot the naval base. Yeah, it was on the island of Kyushu, right across from Honshu. But that was also a big naval base. That's where the bomb was supposed to be dropped. But it was clouded over. They went down south. They passed another naval base, Sasebo. That was also clouded over. Then they came towards the Nagasaki, and there it's all bright and clear. Drop the damn thing and get out of here. So, I mean, you know, this is what I think happened. Mm-hmm. There's no way I can prove that that's true.
Do you feel, I know you say you felt the Imperial Japan was ready to surrender before that, but do you feel that that sped up the end of the war and maybe spared you from some other situations you might have encountered?
Yeah, I think personally that President Truman made the right decision based on what the military was telling him. If they didn't drop the bomb, we had to go in, there would be so many U.S. soldiers there, so many Japanese soldiers, and both sides would have taken huge losses. The estimate was maybe the U.S. would lose 510,000 men. Japanese would lose maybe 2 million. So if Olympia went through and then continued on, it would have gone into the island of Honshu, and more people would have got killed. So what President Truman saw was it was the right thing to do to end the war with the bomb, atom bomb. By doing that, he saved so many million lives. And that's my understanding why the bomb was dropped in the first place.
So the work that you did as a translator, interpreter, and interrogator, first there on Saipan and Tinian, how aware were you of what had happened there? The thing that jumps out at me for Saipan is that suicide cliff where so many Japanese were deceived into taking their own lives, even their children's lives. Is that something that became clear to you at the time as you talked to some of the locals in their language?
Yeah, actually, I was there after the war, so I don't know too much what happened, but I read about it. So there's a Hawaiian guy, Kubo. He was kind of a brave soldier. He was with the 27th Infantry. He would go into a cave where there were some holdout soldiers, but the soldiers were keeping some civilians hostage too. So he went in several times, unarmed, try to get some 20 soldiers to surrender. The third time out, he finally got the right message to them, and he told the soldiers, "Don't die for the emperor. Stay alive for your family." So that's what turned them over to his side, and they surrendered, and then all the civilians came behind them. Bob Kubo also got the information that there was going to be a gyokusai. Gyokusai is a suicide banzai charge, and it would be in a couple of days. Yeah, this was before the end of the war, and it was still in 1944. But Bob Kubo was able to get the information that there's going to be this gyokusai, and he related to his commanding officers, and they got ready for that gyokusai charge, and they wiped them all out. But because of Bob's bravery, he got the soldiers to surrender and got the information about the gyokusai. He was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal, the third highest, you know, award But he's the only Nisei in the Pacific that I know had won a, you know, honor, like a, you know, distinguished service medal. Most of the other guys, like Dick Kishiwe, was a 27th Infantry, same outfit. He only got probably a Bronze Star Combat Infantry badge. But most of the other guys, they never got anything.
Until 10 years ago this week, when all Nisei veterans of World War II were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. I have some relevant links posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com, including that trailer for the new documentary, Hidden Heroes. And another milestone reached in the last week, birthday number 102 for a man who might be the oldest museum docent in America. His name is Bill Barrett, and you'll find him every Saturday at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum in Pueblo, Colorado, where Bill decided to volunteer over a decade ago when he was only 91.
I was beginning to be a little bored staying at home, so I kind of looked around for something to do. I saw an ad in our local paper that they were needing help here at the museum, so I came out and talked to him, and I was hired to be a volunteer, and I've been here ever since.
And you spend most of your time in the gift shop,
I do, yes. I do not walk too well anymore, and there's a lot of walking to if you're a tour guide.
What are the big items in the gift shop that you see a lot of people snatching up?
We have a lot of toys for kids, a lot of airplanes, and a lot of our stuff goes to kids, especially if they're with Grandpa.
Yeah, and I bet they are. And you have two hangars worth of historic aircrafts here. Do you have a favorite? Is something that's on display at this museum?
Probably my favorite at the museum is the B-29 that we have here. They call it Peachy, and the reason it is called Peachy is that there was a young man from Pueblo that was a B-29 pilot. He had a sister he called Peachy. So when we got the aircraft here, we had to name it Peachy.
I guess you did, yeah. Does it look like the ones you saw in the Pacific during World War II?
Very much so.
And Pueblo has quite a history with World War II. This airstrip we're next to had some bombers flying off of it.
They trained the crews here for the B-24s, the B-29s, and the B-17s.
So the B-29 here is your favorite. Is there another one or two that you see a lot of people gravitating towards?
And different people like different planes. I like the A-26 real well. And my favorite plane during World War II was the P-38 Lightning.
Well, and you have a picture of yourself on the most famous P-38 Lightning that ever existed, and we're going to get that story from you before we're done here. But the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum is open 7 days a week. If you're lucky, you might run into Bill.
Yes.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
I was working at a drugstore that Sunday. When I got home, I didn't know anything about it at the store, but when I got home, the radio was on and was hearing about what had happened.
Was that pretty jarring?
Yes, it was.
Did you know where Pearl Harbor was?
Not exactly. I knew where Hawaii was, but I didn't know Pearl Harbor.
Had you ever even considered the prospect of war?
No.
Nothing?
No, I never did.
And now all of a sudden, the Japanese have attacked American territory.
Right.
So what'd you do about it?
The war started in December. In January, I went to Kansas City, Missouri, enlisted in the Army, signed some papers, talked to a number of people, and they sent me back home to quit my job and come back at a later date to be inducted.
Why'd you do that? Why did you want to get in the Army? You had a good job.
I just figured it had to do it.
Your country needed you.
Your country needed it.
And you didn't want to wait to be drafted?
I didn't want to be drafted, yeah. I don't know how soon I would have been drafted. At that time, they had drawings for the draft. Everybody had a number, and then every once in a while they'd have a draft and draw out the different numbers.
Did you have an expectation of what you might be doing in the Army?
I had no idea. They didn't ask me what I wanted to do. I was just wound up in the Signal Corps, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and a lot of people these days aren't familiar with the Signal Corps. Or if they do ever hear the Signal Corps, it's maybe they see a photograph from 70 years ago, and it says U.S. you know, Signal Corps at the bottom. So tell us about the Signal Corps.
They sent me from Kansas City to Jefferson Barracks in Missouri. I was just there for a few days. Then I went to Camp Crowder, Missouri, which was an Army Signal Corps training center. The Signal Corps was the Army's way of communicating. Mm-hmm. They did it by radio, telephone, telegraph, in person, carrier pigeon. I don't think we ever used that in where I was, but they used motorcycles some and different types of ways to communicate.
But you probably also had to go through basic training too, right?
Basic training was more or less some of the Signal Corps things that you had to do. I knew how to type because I took typing in high school. I tried to learn the Morse code, but I didn't have the ear for those dots and dashes. Then I got some cryptography training when he was there at Camp Crowder.
Cryptography. So tell us what cryptography is.
Cryptography is the encoding and decoding of messages. From our signal center, every message that went out, every message that came in had to be in code. It was our job to put it into code or decode it and deliver the message to the proper authority.
Did it take you a while to get a handle for that?
Not too much. We had a machine that did a lot of it.
What was that machine called?
It was called SIGABA, S-I-G-A-B-A.
How big was it?
About the size of a teletype machine.
Today, people carry a little machine around in their hand called a smartphone that can outcompute just about anything. But, you know, spatially, how much space did that take
probably up? Probably as big as your laptop.
All right.
Yeah. Only it was complete, you know, it didn't have a frame that came up, or this that came up.
Big and thick and kind of heavy?
Yeah. Real heavy. Yeah.
So what could that machine do?
It encoded and decoded the machines for us.
So you could type in a message in plain English?
Right.
And it would turn it into a code?
Into a code. The way we got that code, the machine had 10 wheels on it.
Uh-huh.
And you had to set those wheels. The first five wheels we set every day at the same – the wheels had the 26 letters of the alphabet on it, each wheel. And then each morning or each at midnight, you had to set those five wheels at a certain number or letters.
Right.
That was given to us by a book we had that told us how to set it. And then on every message, the first 10 digits on the message that came in told us where to set the second wheel.
Okay.
And then you just typed your message and it either decoded or encoded.
So if you get one of those wheels off by one, the whole thing doesn't make any sense.
I don't know.
You never found out?
I never found out about that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So if everything has to be encoded, it means that the nature of these messages that are being transmitted must be fairly sensitive.
We had several different types of messages. We had the routine messages. We had priority messages. We had secret and top secret. But there was five different classifications of messages.
It's time for another break, but we will hear more of Bill Barrett's unique World War II story when we come back. Pueblo, Colorado, the home of heroes, is where you'll find them every Saturday at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.